You're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM, Winnipeg.
Look at what's happened to me. I can't believe it myself. Suddenly I'm up on top of the world. It should have been some.
Welcome to the Meta World Stupaloop Show. I am your host, IMA Karen Elliott. Today on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, we bring you the first of a two-part look at capers involving art. Art theft, heists, yoinking. Whereas vandalism can be seen as an intersection of crime and destruction, art theft is the very intersection between renovation and crime, taking an old drab, run down and long since had its day painting by some dreary old long since decomposed master and making it interesting again, or at least vaguely topical, if only for a very limited period of time. There is some discussion of technique, and although practice makes perfect usually does apply as an axiom. Today we hear all about and even from a dude that just walked in, plucked the Mona Lisa and walked out. Good for him. And off it goes. Don't worry, they have a photocopy. We'll just use different display glass, nobody will notice a thing. But as mentioned, it certainly does add a bit of niche to works that otherwise had not come up in discussion for some time, and let's face it, if not for their thefts, we're not too likely to ever see public discussion again in any context aside from perhaps ticket sales. So, in a way, it's a good way to boost interest. Maybe bump up a price a bit in next year's auction. Sketchy art is indeed a recurrent theme, but it will not become a series. It will, however, return a couple more times in the coming months with looks at the art market, art forgeries and money laundering, but today, it's art theft. Part 1. On the Meta World Stupaloop Show on CKUW, I am A. Karen Elliott.
Who were these persons? They were all coming from the upper class. They were wives of industrialists, of academic professors. So they really came from a very wealthy background.
One person who could easily afford Klimt's prices was Ferdinand Bloch-Bauer, who had amassed a significant collection of Austrian art. The Viennese had a sweet tooth, and he made his fortune by refining sugar. His wife, Adele, became a socialite who organized parties for Vienna's finest at their mansion. Her niece, Maria, was 9 years old at the time.
She surrounded herself with artists, composers. She had what they called a salon at the time. She had all these fabulous people. Richard Strauss and Wassermann. I mean, she had people, painters, poets, composers, and this is where she got her intellectuals.
Klimt was one of the artists who frequented the salon. He became a personal friend, but what would he charge to paint Adele's portrait?
The price at that time was already extreme. It was enormous. I think that it was as high as you could have acquired at that time a whole villa, a good land house, even in the suburbs. It was that high.
It may have been expensive, but Klimt's portrait of Adele would become one of the most famous paintings of the 20th century. This was one of only a handful of paintings from Klimt's famous golden period, in which he produced highly decorative work, resembling a jewel box. Here is Adele in the most lavish dress, adorned with glittering jewelry. We know it took Klimt over a year to finalize the painting, and he visited her many times, making over 200 sketches.
We know from portraits which he prepared for 1 year, just the preparation. That's just thinking about how I want to have the posture of this woman, how should she stand, should she sit, where should be the arms. And so Klimt really thought about all details, and he made sketches of all different postures. I think it makes sense if you think he had really a personal relationship to this woman. He made a kind of reference to her. Because, of course, by meeting so often the person, he gets to know her very well. And it's said, I mean, there are rumors that with some of the sitters, with some of the models, he had even a more close relationship, maybe some sentimental affairs too.
In the paintings of his golden period, Gustav Klimt seems to be capturing the seductive and passionate nature of these women. Many believe that Adele was also the model for The Kiss, one of the most sensual works ever produced. So could Adele have been Klimt's lover?
When I asked my mother, did Adele have a relationship with Klimt, she said, how dare you ask such a question? It was intellectual friendship. But my mother would always say that, even if, when she was 100% sure that the people had more than an intellectual friendship.
An artist asks a snoozing security guard where his subject has gone.
And it's only then that the guard goes to the photography studio, and the photographers have no idea what he's talking about. And that's when the alarms go off.
At this stage, there's still a chance the Mona Lisa might still be in the Louvre.
It may have been taken and hidden. It may have been taken and just put on one side somewhere. So there's quite a lot of uncertainty.
But a few hours later, the deputy director's worst nightmare is realised when he makes a shocking discovery. It's August the 22nd. 1911, and what is now the most famous and most expensive piece of art on the planet, the Mona Lisa, has been missing for more than 24 hours.
The last figures I saw, I think, from the FBI and Interpol that stated that the international trade of not just artwork but artifacts, antiquities, is about $6 billion US. I mean, a thief is going to steal artwork for one reason and one reason only, and that's to make money. Whether they sell it at a ridiculous price, whether they already have a buyer, right? Because there are people throughout the world who are obsessed with their art collections. And maybe it's bragging rights to show off to their rich friends that they have this art piece. If you were to open up a museum or art gallery of all the stolen artwork, you would have an amazing institution with like 166 Rembrandts, 167 Renoirs, and the list goes on and on and on.
In the past, art galleries and museums did not have the kinds of high-tech security systems that are in use today.
Thinking 45 years ago or more, security then would have
actively use stolen art for their own twisted
contacts on exterior. The door said had an audible alarm, so if you were nearby, you could hear the alarm go off.
I don't often get mixed up in the world of organized crime. But now, I'm uncovering the true story behind the most shocking art crime of the 21st century. The theft of some of Van Gogh's most personally charged and cherished paintings.
This forms part of the Impressionist and Modern Art evening sale. We are offering 32 locks at a rough low estimate of around £140 million. This is certainly one of the top pieces in that sale. It's very rare to find a picture of this quality up on the market. Van Gogh oils are pretty rare anyway. I think this is a painting that has huge universal appeal. So we've got a very long list of clients who are looking at it from all over the world.
So we move to the Vincent Van Gogh, the Reaper, painted in Saint-Rémy in 1889. I start this at £9 million, £9 million, £10 million, at £11 million already, £12 million, at £12 million, £13 million is bid, £14 million I have, £15 million, £16 million, £17 million in new place, thank you sir. Welcome into the bidding, £18 million is bid. Many bids in many places, but the gentleman here has it at £19 million, at £19 million for the Van Gogh, £20 million. £20,500,000. 21 million, 21.5 is the American bidder just behind me. For the Saint-Rémy Van Gogh at £21,500,000. Are we all out? Sold to you at £21,500,000. Well done. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
masterpieces snatched from the walls in the middle of the night. A crime that still remains a mystery. News of the heist took over the airwaves and made headlines around the globe. It was, and still is, Canada's largest art heist.
It's a classic Hollywood movie script scene.
Stéphane Aquin has been the museum's director for 2 years now.
From the museum's perspective, you have to deal with this public imagination of the heist as something glamorous. The reality of it is that it's a despicable crime. It has profoundly damaged the museum's reputation, but more so it has deprived Montrealers and the broader community of art lovers of works of art that they have not seen since.
Labor Day weekend, 1972, was an exceptionally turbulent time in Montreal.
Look, I don't think I ever remember a busier weekend news-wise.
Bob Benedetti was a reporter for CTV News back in 1972.
I mean, it started out on the Friday night with the fire at the Bluebird Cafe.
A deliberately set fire ravaged a popular nightclub, killing 37 people.
And then on Saturday night was game one of the Summit Series.
Petrov back to Mihailov, right in the clear, all right in, it's score!
What was supposed to be an easy win for Canada turned into a stunning loss, bringing the greatest hockey nation to its knees. Those distractions turned out to be the perfect opportunity for thieves to target the museum, recently under repair.
What's always been interesting about this theft is that it was a very clever theft.
Catherine Schofield is a Canadian writer who now lives just outside of Rome. She's...
...of restoration. Museums and galleries' primary objective must be to protect the art and antiquities to keep them safe and sound. Even still, FBI reports estimate that the market in stolen art and artifacts is massive, ranking only behind drug and gun trafficking.
You can speak to anyone in law enforcement, especially in the international community, but art theft is certainly recognized as a major crime, international major crime. The last figures I saw, I think, were from the FBI and Interpol, that stated that the international trade, not just artwork, but artifacts, antiquities, was about $6 billion in the U.S. You know, a thief is going to steal artwork for one reason. They already have a buyer, right? Because there are people throughout the world who are obsessed with their art collections. And maybe it's bragging rights to show off to their rich friends that they have this art piece. If you were to open up a museum or an art gallery with all the stolen artwork, you would have an amazing institution with like 166 Rembrandts, 167 Renoirs, and the list goes on.
In the past, art galleries and museums did not have the kinds of high-tech security systems that are in use today.
They rebelled against that in an ordinary life, in a very broad manner, and prided themselves on a stick handling of a sort of revolutionary style and approach to subject matter. Le Puy Noir was from his native region, which is Ornans in eastern France, near Germany. And he actually made very many versions of that particular subject, basically a gorge with a river flowing from it, called Le Puy Noir, probably a better translation would be Black Pool.
Well, the coming storm was painted by a Dutch-born artist called Cornelius Vreeman. Well, it's small and quite meticulously painted, and it shows a foreboding-looking sky. Rushing River, the lower right, and a canoe being hurriedly carried up a bank into the forest. So it's so typical Krieghoff, but he rendered atmosphere beautifully. He was a good, well-trained artist.
Well, he painted exclusively in Quebec province. And he painted between Quebec and Montreal because he lived in both places. So a lot of his scenes are, he's rather like a Canadian Bruegel, you know, Bruegel painted in Europe, peasant scenes, and Cornelius Krieghoff.
Started digging into the Montreal art heist in 2009 and knows the details of this case like the back of her hand.
It seems as if the thieves, and there were three thieves, had some prior knowledge of the goings-on at the museum. They could have been observing the museum for quite some time.
Like cats on the prowl, they snuck up in the dead of night to gain access to the museum.
There was a tree that one of the thieves climbed up using picks on his shoes, similar to a telephone repair man. He goes up the tree, he gets into the roof, he finds a ladder that looks like a construction ladder.
It was this ladder that was lowered down to his accomplices. Benedetti and his news crew found it the very next day exactly where the thieves left it.
The palace, including the Green Vault, is open to the public. While scouting the area beforehand, the burglars identified a weak spot: the windows on the ground floor. When they returned in the early hours of November 25th, 2019, all they had to do was remove the previously detached metal grill and break open the window behind it. Once inside, the thieves had free rein of the Green Vault and its priceless contents.
Right by the window where the thieves broke in. Outside is the grill that they cut apart.
The museum authorities are praying that she could still turn up unharmed when the Louvre's deputy director discovers something that will start a chain of events changing the face of art and crime forever.
They found the frame and the glass protective casing of the Mona Lisa discarded in the service stairwell. And that's really when they say, oh my goodness, this must really have been stolen.
When paintings sell for sums like that, it's hardly a surprise that the art market should have become such a wasp's nest of artful dodgers, dealers with hopeful attributions, forgers, fakers. But the number one dodge is theft. And of all artists whose work have been stolen, Vincent van Gogh ranks pretty much at the top.
Since the Nazis in Germany first confiscated van Gogh paintings in 1937, more than 40 of his masterpieces have been stolen in at least 15 separate heists from galleries all over the world.
Giving them direct access to the treasury chamber.
It's believed that two thieves entered the Green Vault through the window. The treasures there have been on display ever since Augustus the Strong opened his collection to visitors in 1724.
This is the Hall of Treasures, which again shows the diverse range of items collected by the monarchs back then. The thieves weren't interested in Nautilus goblets or ostrich eggs. They quickly passed through this room on their way to the jewelry room.
The thieves came prepared. They knew exactly which route to take, making their way through the coat of arms room before arriving at their destination, the jewelry room. Working against the clock, they broke through the display case with an axe. Housed in the jewelry room are sets of jewels, matching stones commissioned by Augustus the Strong, now missing quite a few pieces.
In diesen Vitrinen befinden sich wertvollste Perlen.
These display cases contain priceless pearls and jewelry belonging to Saxon monarchs. which they collected both for their own prestige and as an investment. And this is what the thieves were after.
Das ist das Ziel der Täter gewesen.
Following safety protocol, security guards called police, but did not intervene. In minutes, the thieves smashed through the display case and grabbed 22 items. The burglars disappeared into the night, and with them, priceless pieces of
Many of those works were eventually recovered, but some are still missing. In Amsterdam in 2002, the race was on to track down the missing paintings from the Van Gogh Museum before they disappeared forever. The Dutch police put one of their top detectives on the case, Bob Schagen.
What was your instinct about the kind of people who'd done this?
Professional burglars, in and out for 3 minutes, very professional, and gone by the wind.
But the thieves had made a crucial mistake.
Inside the smashed window was a head. And downstairs by the rope, we had a cap.
Like a baseball cap?
Yeah, like a baseball cap. Yeah, and then inside the heads were DNA.
Analysis of the DNA led to a clear match from the Dutch database of previously convicted offenders. The chief suspect, Octave Oki Durham, was well known as a professional thief.
And he was known as a very good burglar, so we know that he was specialized in burglaries, in big burglars. And we followed him, and we wanted to see what his behaviors were, and earned he a lot of money, was he spending a lot of money or whatever.
After fleeing to Spain, Oki Durham was eventually arrested in December 2003 and brought back to Holland.
So when you arrested him, was he cooperative? Was he silent? Was he...
No, but he didn't say anything about Van Gogh. He was denying. He didn't say anything.
Not me. Not me.
Not me.
This is an important piece that was handled brutally in the theft. Its return and restoration was a critical priority for the gallery.
This is a wonderful portrait by Henri Fantin-Latour of Henri Fitz-James, painted in 1867. Well, it's a wonderful work to have because really, Fantin-Latour, his career divides itself interestingly into several different subject categories, floral and fruit still life, which mainly did portrait that really underlines.
We know that he had many children, illegitimate children, with women whom he didn't marry, he never was married, but we do not know exactly how many children there are, who were the women. I mean, this is incredible that such a famous painter had so many liaisons who were just hidden.
Whatever the relationship between Adele and the artist, Ferdinand and his wife were delighted with the picture. It wasn't long before the portrait of Adele grasped the imagination of the art establishment. The painting became a centerpiece of Klimt exhibitions. The Blockbauers wanted more Klimts, and they invested in four of his landscapes painted between 1903 and 1916. In the summer, Klimt loved to escape from his studio and head out to the lakes near Strasbourg.
This subject, to which Klimt returned time and again, held a special fascination for him. I think perhaps it's the combination of the natural geometry of the lake shore and then the buildings rising up, but with the steep hill behind them pushing forwards, that held an attraction for him, but also the great natural combination of colours.
Walking by the lake shore, he would be fascinated by the effect of light on the trees and flowers.
was back at the Autumn with a more subdued set of colors.
Here Klimt takes as his subject a birch forest, the innards of the forest, in a glade. There was a reflection of perhaps getting deep into nature, being at the very heart of things. In truth, it's a fairly restricted palette. Green representing the lichen climbing up the trees and the leaf canopy, the russet colours, earth colours for the floor, and then the three silvery colours on the tree trunks.
So Adele and Ferdinand's house in Vienna became home to one of the largest private collections of Klimt paintings. Adele's face seems to have inspired Klimt in his golden period. When he abruptly changed style in 1912, Adele was once again the subject he chose to paint.
So this would be, I would think, very archaic compared to today's standards.
Even still, art thieves needed to be clever and well-informed to pull off a heist. A high-profile robbery in Hamilton, Ontario, in 1960, was only possible because thieves knew enough about the existing security system to find weaknesses in it. Helen Haddon has been a volunteer at the Art Gallery of Hamilton for almost three decades. She vividly recalls events surrounding the robbery.
It was a bold theft with a lot of clumsiness involved. But they were crafty enough to come in a rear door, which did not set off any kind of alarm because the minimal alarm system.
There may have been a door or doors that were not alarmed. A door contact could be easily circumvented not to cause an alarm, or a wire cut, and they would not know it. So yes, it could have been easily done back then.
The Art Gallery of Hamilton is no longer situated in the building that was robbed. The original gallery was opened in 1913 in the space formerly used as the city's public library.
It was a very modest one-floor gallery composed of six rooms. But the thieves elected to break in through a lower panel of the rear emergency exit door, which therefore brought them right into the room called the Jewel Box Room, which contained the masterpieces of the gallery.
The stars of the collection were all conveniently located in this one wing of the gallery, so it was a natural target for the thieves. Dating mostly from the 19th century, the paintings that were stolen are invaluable pieces in art history created by important artists. These are their stories.
Well, Gustave Courbet, along with Manet, considered the two great heroes of French realism in the 19th century, which was an avant-garde movement. As Courbet said, I've never painted an angel because I don't see angels. So this total revolution in art, whereas before there was the Academy telling painters to paint historical subjects and mythological subjects in a very finished style, Courbet rebelled against that and painted ordinary life in a very broad manner.
Regardless of their value in gold or diamonds, they can never be recreated. You won't have the same aura or the same pieces that Augustus the Strong might have held in his hand.
The Green Vault and the loss of important historical artifacts weighs heavily on Ackerman.
You have arrested somebody, but where are the paintings?
I'm not sure there's much that the Van Gogh Museum could have done about it. He smashed the window, but the fact is there was a three-minute window. That was the flaw in the system. If you could do what he could do, you could climb like Oki, get in, get out, make your escape. His mistake was to leave his hat, because inside his hat was hair and in his hair was his DNA, and pretty soon enough they knew who it was who'd done the deed. The problem was, they didn't know where the paintings were.
The Mona Lisa is not in the gallery.
Somehow, one of France's great art treasures has been taken.
This is something that is outrageous. Not a theft. This is an affront.
It's like kidnapping the Queen of England. It's impossible.
The Mona Lisa suddenly becomes this iconic figure.
It's an affront to France that he's been taken.
For a theft of this magnitude, there's only one person the museum can turn to. Louis Lepine.
So who is Louis Lepine? He is the prefect of Paris Police, the most important policeman in France, perhaps the greatest policeman in the world.
Louis Lepine has a sterling and ironclad reputation for Sherlock Holmes of his day, someone who is guaranteed to crack the case.
Late afternoon on Tuesday, August the 22nd, 1911, the world's greatest living policeman is called to investigate the baffling disappearance of the Mona Lisa.
Lepine was a man of action. When he came to the museum, he was with a team of 60 police detectives. This is absolutely enormous.
Lepine was a man who wanted the facts. He wanted a dossier, a thick dossier of the criminal. He wanted the detail.
Lepine, he's well organized, he's systematic, he's very experienced. He knows what he's doing, but he's also concerned about the blow to national pride of a picture being stolen from the Louvre.
And Lepine isn't the only one. A day after the theft, the story is already making the front pages.
Headlines blazed around the world announcing the theft of the Mona Lisa, and the very first one that ran read in French, "Unimaginable!" with an exclamation point.
The early 20th century is the dawn of the information age. Telegrams and radio means that for the first time, news can travel around the world in just a few hours.
There were headlines, famous picture taken from the Louvre. The Washington Post printed a picture of the stolen Mona Lisa. It was the wrong picture. How do you get that wrong? Well, back in 1911, that'll give you an idea of how well known the painting was.
He's been on the case less than 24 hours, but Lepine knows that his investigation is going to be under the media microscope.
In any criminal investigation, the first 24 hours are critical. That's when people's memories are clearest. It's when you're most likely to get reliable witness testimony.
The great detective has a problem, though. He doesn't know when the Mona Lisa was actually taken. The day after the discovery, he conducts interviews with all the museum staff, hoping to find the last person to have seen her or anyone else with vital clues.
In his testimony, the maintenance director of the Louvre, a man called Piquet, tells the investigators that he was in the Salon Carré at 7:30 in the morning, and he remembers seeing the picture in France. He also says that at about 8:35, Annie noticed the picture was not there.
Lepine now knows the hour and 5 minute window when the painting went missing.
Now, the other person who came forward with some important information was a plumber named Jules Sauvet.
He tells Lepine that he saw a man next to a locked exit in the stairwell, close to where the Mona Lisa's frame was discovered.
Now, Sauvet says that he saw this workman sitting there in a white blouse next to the door. He goes up to the door and sees there's no doorknob. And he turns to the man and says, "Do you know where the doorknob is?" The man goes, "No, I have no idea. I just got here myself." So Sauvet happens to have the keys, and he opens the door, goes out, and locks it behind him.
Right away, Lepine and the French police have got a potential suspect. Now they just have to find him.
Eyewitness testimony is notoriously unreliable. Usually it has to be taken very shortly after the event. The problem, of course, for the police is
sort of revolutionary style and approach to subject matter. Le Puy Noir was from his native region, which is Ornans in eastern France, near Germany. And he actually made very many versions of that particular subject.
One of the few ways to track down the pictures was to follow the money.
to find out if the suspects were suddenly flush with cash, and if so, who had it come from? Dutch prosecutor Willem Nykerk.
We had wiretaps where they were talking about a lot of money that they were getting. They never wanted to say where they got the money from.
So the fact that part of your evidence actually has them talking about money, that suggests that they must already have sold the paintings by 2004.
Yes, we have indications that they sold the paintings quite fast. There is a wiretap dated in March 2003. When they are talking about an amount of 50,000 euros, and that was only half of what they were expecting. Also, the police found out that they were buying watches, cars, they made trips to New York, to Disneyland in Paris.
We're confident that it will be returned to us, or parts of it at least. Past cases suggest it might take quite a while, but the main thing is to keep on hoping. 4,300 diamonds were stolen in the Dresden heist, a high-profile case involving three prosecutors and 40 special investigators. Travemünde, on the Baltic Sea, could be seen by some as unethical.
They did what you don't do. A burglary, property damage, they stole valuable things. And because there were more than three, it's a gang theft. That's all it is. There's no life sentence or anything. So I think that's morally defensible.
Less than a year after the heist, his plan seemed to be working. Resch says he was contacted by the thieves looking to return the jewels.
The handovers are pretty much sorted. I can't say, but given the negotiations and my own experience, things are looking up.
In November 2020, Besch was confident the Dresden jewels would soon return. A ransom for stolen art treasures in the form of a table stocked with cash was a new concept for Stefan Koldehoff too.
A private sector bid like this is rare and surprising. Normally the thieves will contact the aggrieved party about an offer. But someone going public, literally putting money on the table, is pretty unusual. And that's because of the unique nature of the Saxon royal treasury.
Koldehoff has spent years writing about art crime. Germany alone sees an average of four works stolen every day. One factor, he says, is that art is becoming increasingly expensive and lucrative.
There's never been so much money in the art market. As gallery owners and auction houses will tell you, when banks offer zero interest and you already have enough villas and yachts and pricey watches, having a Banksy or a Van Gogh or Gerhard Richter on the wall becomes a status symbol. And that's something people with enough money are willing to pay a lot of money for.
Eager art investors can be found at events like Art Basel. The fair brings together the worlds of art and finance, with wheeling and dealing conducted over champagne and oysters.
This is your typical Basel crowd. The art here ranges from classical modern to contemporary, so that attracts young and old collectors.
The week-long Art Basel fair features paintings, sculptures, and photos from around 270 galleries. Among them, this work by influential American artist Jean-Michel Basquiat.
This is priced at $40 million. There have been Basquiats that cost a lot more money than this, some larger in size. But for this one, $40 million is set in stone.
New York-born Jean-Michel Basquiat was the first black artist to break into the otherwise white-dominated Western art market. Prices for his works have risen dramatically since he died at just 27 in 1988.
This is a smaller format.
this is a smaller work that went for the asking price of $3 million in the first day.
This cheap wooden ladder leaning on the back wall of the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts was the route to $2 million worth of art treasures.
Who hasn't read a novel about a big art heist? So this was a chance to be part of a novel. That's the first thing that struck me when we got the call that this had happened.
Benedetti soon learned that the thieves' plan was sneaky, but genius. They took full advantage of a skylight under repair.
It appears that there was a plastic tarp placed over the skylight for this repairs construction, and this is what deactivated the alarm. There was a very specific section of the skylight that was disarmed. If they had entered the skylight from another place, they maybe would have activated the alarm.
After the picture's been taken, even the plumber who opened the door didn't really pay any attention. It was just another employee who couldn't get out of a door.
So the police have very little to go on. They have the frame and they have the eyewitness reports from the plumber in the stairwell. Where do they look now? What is the thrust of their investigation?
Louis Lepine has a trump card. He is a forward-thinking police officer, and he's interested in this new field of investigative forensics.
Observation, skill at painting, and then that quiet reserve yet intense presence that he gives to his sitters. And it's an interesting work as well in terms of the fact that it's a rare work. It's related to a commission for a large group portrait of the Dowager Duchess de Fitzjames and her 15 grandchildren that was never realized. Supposedly the artist found it difficult to pose that many small children and keep them still long enough to paint them. But for me, Fantin Latour has always had a special place in my heart because of his skill and that quiet presence that he gives to his portraits. So it's wonderful for me to have this portrait in our collection.
Then the other Canadian artist involved was James Wilson Maurice of Montreal, who grew up with a wealthy background and was trained in the law, but largely lived his life abroad in Europe, largely in France. But he was also sort of a bird of passage, and he painted in other countries like Morocco with Matisse. And his works are small but exquisite. And there was our works that were stolen were largely Venetian subjects. So there were three in the theft. By Maurice.
And one of them is carrying a shotgun, a sawed-off shotgun.
Inside the museum, there were three security guards. But the burglars fired a gunshot into the air to scare them. They surrendered. Bound and gagged, the three men on duty were helpless to halt the heist.
If we look at the list of the 17 works that they take, they would have taken essentially the most valuable works that we had in the museum at the time. A painting by Delacroix, two beautiful Corot paintings, and something that is extremely rare in the field of art history is a landscape painting by Rembrandt. So really, truly, they knew what they were after. It was not random.
The thieves ripped pieces of art off the walls, stacking them to make an easier escape.
Paintings were taken out of their frames. Frames were thrown on the ground. The entire place was a site of destruction.
They're breaking them, Catherine, to get the painting
exactly.
out to make it more exactly. transportable, right?
Exactly.
But the relatively smooth operation hit a snag. The thieves did make one mistake. They opened the side door, which triggered an alarm.
This black door right behind me here is the one that set off the burglar alarm, causing the thieves to speed up their escape. Behind them, they left another 12 paintings, also worth about $2 million.
In a mad dash, the burglars scrambled to grab whatever they could, taking off down Sherbrooke Street into the night.
It does appear that possibly they had another truck nearby, because they couldn't have gone very far down Sherbrooke, carrying three men with ski caps on, in dark clothes probably, running down the street with a bunch of paintings. How far are you going to go on a busy main thoroughfare in Montreal?
Intrepid reporter Benedetti was once again asking questions.
Okay. On camera is Bill Banty, a spokesman for the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts. Were the guards injured in any way?
No, the guards were not injured. They were manhandled, perhaps. But a shot was fired. Happily, the shot did not hit any one of the guards. All three of them were tied and bound and guarded.
How about the material they left behind, 12-odd paintings, including a very valuable Rembrandt?
Yes, there were some other paintings that they had obviously planned to take with them.
This is a crime scene photograph of the art left behind.
One is the corner of the Doge's Palace in Venice, and one is called Etude Venise, which shows a woman with auburn hair in the foreground, and the other is another Venetian subject.
Some of the stolen works were created in very significant art communities and movements.
Still Life by Georges Braque from 1926. And Georges Braque, again, a major European modernist of the 20th century, who, along with Pablo Picasso, invented Cubism in the early part of the 20th century. This particular work comes from later in his career, but you can certainly still see the influence of Cubism with the flat decorative shapes, form, abstracted forms of the objects, whether the fruit or the cup on the table.
In 1911, forensic science is in its infancy, but Louis Lepine is a pioneer of this new policing tool. In fact, he's one of the first policemen to use fingerprinting as a means of identification in the world.
Lepine is hoping that the thief was foolish enough to leave fingerprints at the crime scene, because this is before it was common knowledge that if you steal something, you wear gloves.
Hoping that science can crack this case, Lepine calls on France's foremost fingerprint recovery and analysis expert, Alphonse Berthoud.
First thing they looked at was the empty frame with its glass, and they noticed right away there were fingerprints. First clue.
Using graphite powder, Bertillon uncovers a large number of smudges and one clear fingerprint. Just a few days after the theft, police have another potential clue.
Now, from Lepine's perspective, this is the jackpot. All he has to do is match it to the database of criminals who were arrested and had their fingerprints taken.
The only problem was the police have a database of 750,000 cards with fingerprints on them.
A gorge with a river flowing from it, called the Puy Noir, probably a better translation would be Black Pool.
Well, the coming storm was painted by a Dutch-born artist called Cornelius Krieghoff. Well, it's small and quite meticulously painted, and it shows a foreboding-looking sky at the right and the rushing river. A canoe being hurriedly carried up the bank into the forest. So it's so typical Krieghoff, but he rendered atmosphere. He was a good, well-trained artist. Well, he painted exclusively in Quebec province, and he painted, and it was painted in France.
Challenge for the thieves. Martin Luther's Doubts by James Tissot was savagely slashed down the middle when frustrated thieves couldn't remove it from its backing.
And it resisted their efforts, so it was thrown to the floor and smashed. And another smaller work, but very valuable work, was snapped in two. So all the frames were broken and the works were removed, rolled up.
The next morning, the gallery's superintendent arrived at work and discovered the devastating evidence of the theft. In Gallery 6, 10 frames lay broken and empty. Most pieces were on canvas and were cut out of their frames, presumably for ease of transport and concealment. But one painting proved too much of a challenge for the thieves. Martin Luther's Doubts by James Tissot was savagely slashed down the middle when frustrated thieves couldn't remove it from its backing.
The fingerprint that they had, they didn't know if it was a thumbprint, they didn't know if it was a fingerprint. In other words, they would have had to go through 750,000 cards times 10 prints to be able to match it.
Manually checking the files would take French police months, if not years, to do.
What's the next step? How do you limit your suspects from 750,000 people in the fingerprint database down to a manageable number that you could go out and question?
Almost immediately, Louis Lepine shows why he is known as the world's greatest living detective when he makes an observation that helps him narrow the search considerably.
And he immediately noticed that the painting had been taken off the frame in a very proper and very respectful way. So it was done by somebody who had been careful not to damage the painting.
This observation allows Lepine to start compiling a profile of the potential thieves, and it highlights what could be his Achilles heel.
Amsterdam is not only famous for its art, it's also been plagued by a violent criminal underworld. I've been told that in early 2003, Oki Durham attempted to sell the stolen Van Gogh paintings to a notorious figure in that Dutch underworld, Cor van Hout, who, amongst other serious crimes, had previously been involved in the kidnapping of the heir to the Heineken fortune. Oki and Cor were said to have been negotiating the price for the stolen pictures, but then Cor was suddenly assassinated in a gangland hit. That left Oki and his accomplice with a major problem. They needed a new buyer.
There is one tantalizing piece of evidence from a police wiretap made before Oki D was arrested, in which he describes the moment when he sold the paintings. He received the money, apparently, in a notorious club in the center of old Amsterdam, and he received it from a mysterious man called Pinocchio. Then the trail went cold. They couldn't find anybody with an alias Pinocchio.
Oki Durham was put on trial in May 2004. The DNA and the wiretaps were enough to put him away. He was sentenced to 4.5 years in prison and ordered to pay 350,000 euros in compensation to the Van Gogh Museum. But he still wasn't saying what had happened to the paintings. Some organization or somebody was keeping him very quiet indeed.
I was struck by something that the judge said at the end. He said something about what the crime was. Crime against culture.
Cultural heritage, Dutch cultural heritage. These are very important works of art. And it really struck me that they were stolen just for ordinary money and buying watches, going to New York, buying a car. These guys didn't know whatsoever what they were doing.
In Holland, it's as if Dutch art really is part of the soul of the nation.
I hope it is, at least for a lot of people. I don't think for the two burglars that were convicted in this case, I don't think they are art lovers, but mostly the Dutch, they do love art, yes.
Some works are subject to aggressive competition. When some collectors know a piece like this will be on show in Basel, they are determined to turn up right when the fair opens. Because the second it's on.